Welcome to the CSIS Cogitasia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start, as we always do, with the region's news. In eastern Japan, nearly 1 million citizens have been evacuated due to extensive flooding across 10 prefectures. 3 Japanese citizens have drowned, while several dozen have been reported missing. Consistent downpours for a month, coupled with intense rain from Tropical Storm Etau, have resulted in record-high rainfalls for many localities. Japanese self-defense forces have rescued hundreds of people via helicopter as homes and structures flooded in a matter of minutes after levees broke on swollen rivers across northeast Japan. In India, a court in Mumbai has found 12 men guilty for their roles in the bombing of commuter trains in 2006. The men were accused of waging war against the Indian nation, conspiracy, and murder. A series of explosions on July 11, 2006 killed 189 people and wounded over 800. The attack was blamed on Islamic militants backed by Pakistan's intelligence agency, a charge which Pakistan has repeatedly denied. In Canberra, the government of Australia announced it plans to take in an additional 12,000 Syrian and Iraqi refugees while vowing to expand its airstrike campaign to assist in crippling ISIS. Prime Minister Tony Abbott announced the military would be targeting Daesh in Syria and not the Assad regime, the primary objective of preventing cross-border attacks into Iraq. The refugees are projected to cost the federal budget an additional $700 million Australian dollars over the next 4 years. In Seoul this week, South Korean President Park Geun-hye pledged to contribute $100 million to poorer countries as part of the global health security agenda. Over the next 5 years, the money will be dispersed to help 13 countries in Africa and Southeast Asia combat infectious diseases. In Washington, newly released Pew Research Center polling data on U.S.-China relations ahead of the Obama-Xi summit shows U.S. favorability of China has dropped considerably. Overall, only 38% of Americans surveyed had a favorable outlook on China, with 54% described their view as unfavorable. The majority of the Americans surveyed had concerns with China regarding economic ties, cybersecurity, human rights, and environmental issues. And that's the news. We now turn to Singapore's elections, where residents went to the polls this week for the first time since the death of transformational leader Lee Kuan Yew. My colleague and editor of the CSIS Asia Policy blog, Jeff Bean, joined Sumitro Chair Ernie Bauer to analyse the earlier election results and assess what it means for the future of Singapore's politics.
Hi, my name is Jeff Bean, editor of the CSIS Asia Policy blog. Today I'm joined by Ernie Bauer, Senior Advisor and Sumitro Chair for Southeast Asia Studies, to discuss Singapore's general elections, which concluded actually on Friday night, local time. We're recording on Friday afternoon. And Ernie, we've started to receive early sample returns and some of the results. This election is obviously important because it's the first general election since revered figure Lee Kuan Yew's death. It is also the first election since the PAP, the People's Action Party's relatively poor performance in the 2011 elections. Can you give us a little background about what shaped the pending election and some of the issues that were on the table for the Singaporean people?
Interesting timing for the election. It certainly happened on their 50th anniversary and shortly after Lee Kuan Yew passed. So the PAP wisely snapped the election at a time when national pride was high, probably a bit of anxiety among Singaporeans about their future in terms of leadership. Good news for PAP and Lee Kuan Yew's son, the Prime Minister, Prime Minister Lee, and his party, the People's Action Party. They seem to have clawed back some ground that they lost in 2011 from the opposition. Well, we don't know the full results yet. It looks like they may have pulled one of the 7 seats that the opposition had back over. So compared to 2011, where they lost 6 seats, this is an impressive performance by the PAP, particularly in the light of the fact that the opposition has gotten much more organized since 2011 and actually competed for the first time in all 89 seats that are in parliament.
And what do you think were some of the issues coming into the election specifically that shaped the PAP's resurgence or relative resurgence?
Well, I think the PAP went to the ground. They went down to the ground and understood the concerns of Singaporeans on a couple issues. I think the primary ones were immigration. PAP, led by Lee Kuan Yew's vision, was ultimately practical about economic competitiveness. And so they were searching for the world's best talent, happy to have workers from other parts of the world come in. But obviously, Singaporeans felt exposed by this. And it also drove up the cost of living in Singapore. So a little bit like the case of, sort of Californians coming into Oregon. I mean, I think Singaporean voters thought this is great, and on the one hand, but there was a growing gap between the Singaporeans that were benefiting from this very free market economic competitiveness strategy and those who didn't benefit and actually who lived in the middle of the country, largely, who couldn't find jobs or couldn't find jobs that would pay enough for them to live and prosper in their own country. And I think that's what that sentiment is something that the Worker Party and the other opposition parties really grabbed in 2011. And it's one there that the PAP leadership really tried to address more thoroughly in the lead up to this election.
Now, what does this mean on a broader perspective in terms of Singapore's leadership role within ASEAN and its important role globally for the PAP going forward? Do you expect any significant changes? And what is your sort of longer-term outlook on these issues?
I think the message here is continuity. And actually, that's an important message within ASEAN, because if you look around the neighborhood, Jeff, you see the ties in sort of an existential struggle for reordering of power. You see Najib under real pressure politically in Malaysia. You've got an election coming up in the Philippines where Aquino, who was very popular with Filipinos, will be replaced. He's term limited. And even a party, you have elections in Myanmar and a party congress coming up in Vietnam. So a lot of churn in the neighborhood. Singapore looks very stable. I expect a lot of continuity on foreign policy, on economic policy. I think one thing that investors who are looking at the region will find is that you may have a further tightening of rules about what workers you can bring in to your company in Singapore. That could put some pressure even on skilled and high-level positions. And I think that's something that, Singapore will have to fight through this balance. They're moving into more normal politics, and that even the opposition, although very small, there is an opposition voice, and people will have a vehicle to express concerns about the number of foreign workers, even top-level workers coming into the country. So I think this is something the Singaporeans will have to balance with their competitiveness.
Ernie, thanks for joining us. We'll have to watch the final outcome of the election this weekend, but I appreciate you taking the time to sit down with us.
Thanks, Jeff.
And that was Ernie Bauer. For our one to watch this week, we turn to Indonesia, where a recurring problem keeps reigniting. Indonesian officials said on Friday it will send more than 10,000 soldiers to fight fires on Sumatra, as intense smoke has made thousands sick, delayed regional air travel, and lowered air quality to toxic levels in neighboring Singapore and Malaysia. Indonesia has said before it would end the late summer fires, but has once again failed to stop the so-called haze. The haze is caused by large fires in the islands of Sumatra and Borneo, where vast areas of forest property are owned by influential pulp and paper and palm oil companies. The smoke then drifts into populated areas and across borders. The issue was supposed to be addressed nearly more than a decade ago as part of an ASEAN agreement on transboundary haze signed in 2002, negotiated specifically to deter Indonesia. Ultimately, the fires and the haze continue. And that's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and also check out our island tracker and maritime specific analysis on the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colin Quinn. Thanks for listening.